Hey everybody, it's Devin.
And Kate.
Welcome to Med Crimes, I hope.
Guys don't even know the cascade of wildness that just occurred in this basement. So first of all, I have the Rona, which is unfortunate. I'm doing fine, but if I sound a little crispy or snotty, that is why. And we've been trying to
do this whole remote thing for
and it's been laden with technical issues. So we are hoping that this works.
I hope.
Yeah.
I hope. It's been 45 minutes, and it's going to be, this is what remote recording's going to be for the next, 6 months of cold and flu season, this will be fun. You're in for a real treat.
it's going to be an experience. It's going to be something. I don't know if fun is the right term. It's all good, though. It's fine.
I mean, yeah. All right.
So I tested positive for the Rona today. So my husband, being very responsible, took the kids to our campground and left me all by myself in the house, all by myself, lonesome. And it's very lonely.
Poor you.
And
a mother alone in her house. Poor you.
Listen, I know. At first I got a little excited and was like, wow, some me time. But very quickly I made the terrible decision to watch a terrifying movie all by myself in the dark in my empty house. And I'm a huge horror fan. I love horror movies. Devin knows this. We go way back. We've always watched, scary, crazy movies together. But being a mom has made me soft and everything scares me. And so I'm not someone who used to be easily terrified, but you guys, I just started watching this movie, this horror movie that just came out this year out of Australia called Talk to Me. And I'm not even done with it yet. I had to pause it so that we could record this. And I'm like, I don't think I'm going to finish it tonight. I'm going to finish it tomorrow in the broad daylight at 8 a.m.
You had to stop it. Listen, you had to stop it so that you could come downstairs to the basement and talk to me.
Yeah. So I flicked on the lights and I walked down the basement and Devin was on the phone on a video call with me and I went, ah! And she was like, what? And I was like, I saw something scurry across the floor and I thought it was a demon and it was actually a cricket. So that's where my head's at right now. And I just want you all to just know that and appreciate that in this moment. You're welcome.
She's on edge.
To answer your question, yes, we have Patronuses. We have a lot of them.
We got Patronuses. A lot? Yeah?
Yeah, we have a lot. I was like, what? You guys are awesome. For realsies.
I am ready. This is my favorite part of every other Tuesday.
I know. So we have Eloise White.
I love your name, Eloise White. Thank you so much, Eloise. That is beautiful.
We then have Taylor Eller. Hi, Taylor. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We love you.
Hi, Taylor.
Next, Christina Demiani.
Love that.
I love that.
That's a cute name.
And you know what I love more is that she messaged me and told me specifically how to pronounce her name so I didn't butcher it. So thank you, Christina Demiani. That was very much appreciated.
We love the tips. We love the tips.
Haley Philp. Hi, Haley Philp.
Oh, hi, Haley.
Girl, Haley Philp, you're the best. And then we have Kirsten Boyer. Hi, Kirsten.
Oh, Kirsten Boyer.
I love a Kirsten. I always, always, always love a Kirsten. So, you guys, oh my gosh, I'm overwhelmed by all the love and support we've gotten.
That was a group of five. Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
I'm quite overwhelmed with just all the support and all the love that we've gotten over the past several months. It's just been insane. It just feels like it. Every time I'm feeling down, I just get a little message or a new Patreon or just a little
We've been on a good run. We've been on a good run the last few months.
100% we have. And it's just been really fulfilling and just a really happy, happy time for us. So thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone. We really appreciate all of you.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we
keep
do.
Keep those Patreons coming so we can do a lucky number 100.
Yup, absolutely. And okay, so this is what... Okay, you guys need like a really good mythical creature because I'm feeling like especially spicy today. You know what you guys are? I know. Okay. I don't know if you can tell, but I've had it because I'm running out of mythical creatures that are just in my memory bank. I'm having to look them up and like assign, like actually look things up. Okay. So, oh, I have it now. I have it. You guys are Fenrirs. Fenrir. F-E-N-R-I-R. You are giant wolves. Giant mythical wolves that live in the forest and just tear shit apart because you're gnarly and you're awesome and you're magical and you... thankfully don't actually exist because that would be really scary, but you're awesome in the universe that you are in. So thank you, Fenrirs. We love you. Oh, guys, I am so ready to bring you part dose of Linda Hazard, and I have a teeny tiny little surprise about that.
She's got a confession.
I got a confession. I could not wrap it up in two parts. We are going to have a third part. I'm sorry. Let's talk about where we left off, shall we? Are we ready? Are we ready for this?
Yep.
So where we left off, Linda Hazard was brought up in like the mid to late 1800s in this family setting of like this restrictive dieting. And her parents had followed this like kind of quack of a practitioner who had her medicated in an effort to eradicate intestinal parasites that may or may not have existed with high doses of mercury. So she was literally like being mercury poisoned throughout her childhood along with her siblings. And it gave her some chronic health issues.
Which is terrible.
Oh my gosh, it's catastrophic. And it gave her a lot of chronic medical issues, chronic health issues, and she formed like this sort of distaste for modern medicine because of it. And after having some unhappiness with her marriage and with motherhood, she decided to pursue a career as an osteopath, which unfortunately she could not hack a traditional program because she had such a problem with the fundamentals of science and medicine, like anatomy and you know, things like how they actually worked.
Which,
and
you know, you kind of need that basic. You like, kind of got to have it.
In general, yes, you do. But she just wanted to not like accept any of that and just form her very own ideas and opinions of how things actually worked. So she breaks out, studies on her own under the guidance of this retired army surgeon named Dr. Dewey, who shares her beliefs in naturopathic medicine, and in particular a fasting being like this cure-all. So she starts advertising herself as a doctor, and when she went and opened a practice in Minneapolis, she was felt to be responsible for the death of a patient who sought help for paralysis following a stroke. And this like blew up in the media. She was caught in this messy love triangle media circus thing that's kind of comical when you think about it.
Right.
Because she went and married this guy who was already married, and he actually ended up doing like time for this, like for bigamy.
You can't do that.
You can't do that. Spoiler alert. That's against the law. So he gets out of jail. He chooses her. They take off together to Seattle, hoping to start anew in Seattle. And she somehow gets herself licensed to practice medicine in Seattle due to poor laws and regulations around licensing, just like there was in Minneapolis, and has already now caused the starving death of a 38-year-old named Daisy Haglund. So,
which sounds awful.
Oh my gosh.
With the way she passes, it's just insane.
Just the most horrifying process. I mean, I think about when I'm like a little bit hungry and I'm miserable. Like, if I'm a little thirsty, being thirsty is like one of the worst feelings to me. And like, feed me now or I will get very grumpy. I cannot imagine. Can you imagine dying? Dying of thirst and hunger must just be the most excruciating thing.
As soon as you told me about this fasting treatment plan, I was like, this is not me.
This is not for me.
I'm
this
out.
Is not, I do
Tap.
Not subscribe. Yep. I am bowing out. Respectfully bowing out. So after the starvation death of this third patient in Seattle, Linda felt a need to sort of document all of her rationales and belief system because she thought that that might give her methods a little bit more validity among the community if there was like a written tome of all of this. So she starts writing a book about her methodologies, her beliefs, and her whole fasting regimen, and which includes the exercise and the starvation and the enemas and everything that she believes so heavily in. And she gave specific instructions on how to follow this at home. And she repeatedly claims in her book, first of all, that food is the root cause of any and all medical problem that you have. And the reason why things go wrong within the body are because of the foods that we eat, which our bodies are just not meant to handle. And, you know, maybe that's true for some things that are very highly processed. But like in general, I think the human body needs food. Like that's a pretty fundamental situation. And she followed in the footsteps of her predecessor, Dr. Dewey, and she wrote a book. And in 1908, she self-published this book, which ended up being called Fasting for the Cure of Disease. So this book hits the market, and she starts advertising it on her own, first of all, among her patients in the clinic. She takes out ads in papers. She spreads, you know, word by word of mouth. And a lot of people actually start reading this book and get like heavily into it. And it actually gained a lot of notoriety. And pretty quickly, it began to spread like across the world. Like there are other countries that got a hold of this book and that were reading about her methods. And she became somebody that people like knew about because of this book. So interesting turn of events, given her history. And of course, back then, there's no like, you know, social media or internet to like expose her of as what correct, she actually was. Correct. So
to get the word of mouth out.
Exactly. So it's interesting the way that happened. And in 1909, a young man presents in Linda's clinic with complaints of indigestion. And this was Earl Edward Erdman. And right away, Linda starts Earl on this routine of very restrictive fasting, massage, or beatings is what they really were.
I mean, that part I could go for.
I mean, massage sounds nice. Daily enemas. No, thank you. That's not for me. And rigorous exercise. About 2 weeks into this program, a friend who was visiting Earl at home noticed that he was weak, he was shaky, his eyes were sunken in, and he had lost tremendous amounts of weight. And this friend recalls that Earl just looked like a skeleton. Like, he looked like this old man. And his friend, like, pleaded with him, Earl, please stop doing whatever it is that you're doing. It's clearly causing a lot of harm. You look awful. You feel awful. Please stop. Earl refused.
Eat something.
Earl refused and continued to follow Linda's program. He was just absolutely convinced that if I could just make it to the end, that it will cure me of all of my ailments and I won't have any more issues. Remarkably,
I want to know what spiel she gave to these people that made it seem like this was a good idea.
The you manipulation know, like, tactics here must have just been absolutely uncanny for her to, you know, grab people. And, you know, the problem is, you know, people trusted people that were physicians, you know, and right, people think she's a doctor and she's not. And there's no way for people, you know, people hear that and they assume, oh, wow, this person is very smart. They've studied a lot and their methods have been proven, when in fact, that's not the case. She is literally a fraud and people have no way of really knowing that. So it's really sad for these people that, you know, are trusting her because she's advertising herself as a doctor and she's not.
Right.
So one remarkable thing about Earl's case is that he actually kept a diary of all of his activities and everything he consumed during the time that he fasted. So I'm going to read a few of the entries that were here just so we know like what his days looked like. So on day one, he ate no breakfast, but for lunch and dinner, he ate mashed soup. I'm not sure exactly what mashed soup is.
And how much?
I don't know. It just says mashed soup. I'm assuming like a little cup or a little bowl. A few days later, he ate one orange for breakfast, mashed soup again for lunch and dinner. No snacks in between any of these meals. Another day, he had a single orange for each meal. So it's also important to note here that Linda, again, did not believe in eating meat. So these people were not taking in any protein whatsoever. And when on any sort of diet, there's considerable research out there that recommends getting high amounts of protein, and it's actually the most important macronutrient. When you're on an incredibly restrictive diet and not taking adequate protein, that can lead to malnutrition very quickly, as well as that breakdown of, and digestion of those other tissues that we talked about in part one, you know, like our muscle tissues and our organ tissues. And you have to have protein. You have to have a protein source no matter what it is. Another day with another entry, he ate a single cup of tomato broth and nothing else.
That sounds lovely.
It's unclear if he was taking fluids between these meals, because it seemed like he was documenting everything that he was taking in, and he did not document that he was drinking any water or anything between any of this. So it's kind of widely believed that these broths and soups he was getting was also the only fluid that he was taking in during this time. It seems like the diet that Linda was prescribing was also extremely acidic. Like everything that they're allowed to eat, like oranges and tomato broth, those are very, very high acid foods. And a diet that high in acid can actually throw off your body's whole pH and lead to like widespread inflammatory disorders, gastrointestinal issues, electrolyte balance issues. Along with the muscle wasting due to the severe protein deficiency, this probably made people very sick very fast. So based on what Earl was documenting here, he was consuming only a few hundred calories a day, max, like maximum. So for a young man of average build, this would be nowhere near enough nutrition to sustain him for any significant length of time. We all have what's called a basal metabolic rate, or a BMR. And this is the minimum amount of energy or calories expended just to operate your body functions and cellular processes without even expending any energy. So this is the amount of energy and calories we burn just by being alive, even if we just sat there and did nothing. So this covers
just
our breathing.
Breathed.
Yeah. Digestion, heart beating, you know, our cells working. This is the minimum amount of energy we must consume in order to keep those processes going. So if we were just to lie there and do absolutely nothing, the average male in 1909 would have been about 5'8" and weighing in at about 160 pounds. So taking that into account, and I don't have Earl's exact measurements here, but based on averages, his basal metabolic rate likely would have been of around 2,065 calories per day. And that's wow. Just his basal metabolic rate, meaning that in order mm-hmm. just to exist, if he did absolutely nothing physical all day, he needed at least 2,065 calories per day. So he is in a massive calorie deficit. Actually, massive is like an understatement. He's not even close to his goal.
Negligent calorie deficit.
Humongous. So after about the 2-week mark, Earl had begun documenting physical manifestations that he was having. So he starts documenting that he's having more dizziness, that he was extremely fatigued, and a friend who went to visit Earl in March was so incredibly concerned with the state that they found him in that he actually called an ambulance, and they transferred him to Seattle City Hospital. And at the hospital, doctors and nurses were shocked by his state. They recalled that he was incredibly cachectic and frail. They prescribed him a blood transfusion. So back in the day, they obviously couldn't like measure hemoglobin in any way like we do now, but they would prescribe blood transfusions based on clinical evidence of anemia, like pallor, weakness, fatigue, which he had all of. Unfortunately, while they were preparing to transfuse him, he passed away before they could even give it to him. So he died that day in the hospital. So when Linda gets wind that Earl died at the hospital, she immediately wants to control this narrative, because last time this happened, things got very out of hand for her very quickly. And a lot of it was because another clinician was involved and they performed the autopsy. So she insists on performing Earl's autopsy. I'm just going to go ahead and reiterate that Linda is not a doctor. She is not a physician.
Nope.
She is not any nope. type of anything, but she's just going to go ahead and perform a whole ass autopsy. Because she's insisting to do so. So she
Because
she thinks she can, and she has this credential. So, like, everyone's like, whatever, I guess. The lady's a doctor. Let her do it. So she does the autopsy, and she notes during his autopsy mm-hmm. that his organs were of, quote, infantile size. So she tries to take this information and spin it as though Earl was born with some, like, congenital anomaly.
Oh, come on.
In fact, his organs were most likely very atrophied due to the severe malnutrition and, like, organ wasting that comes with that. So the media did not believe that excuse, that his organs were tiny and that he was born weird and that that killed him. The media, that did not fly. So the media gets wind of all of this because this guy ended up in the hospital and a lot of people saw how he was. This crazy explanation of Earl's death did not sway the papers from publishing stories all about this. So shortly after Earl's death, the Seattle Times runs a story with the headline, quote, "Woman MD kills another patient," end quote. While
I like that quote.
I mean, I do, but also, like, I hate that they're like, "Woman MD kills another patient," MD, because I hate it because what they're trying to infer is that this woman doctor is doing a terrible job. This woman is crazy. And it's all like, you know what I mean? It's like, well, trust me, there was a lot of bad male doctors, too. Don't you worry.
Yes.
Not that she's a doctor,
absolutely,
but I'm just saying, like, I feel like that's what that quote was going for. And
absolutely true.
White on rice, the media was all over this, and suddenly she starts getting bad publicity again, and it's all feeling very familiar. And the problem was nobody could frickin' prosecute her because, much like in Minneapolis, there were no specific laws pertaining to what she was doing here specifically. Again, Earl had followed Linda's advice completely on his own volition, and although she was licensed this time around to practice medicine, the way the laws were laid out in the state of Washington at this time, this did not technically constitute malpractice. She did not prescribe
him. Why?
Because she did not prescribe him a medication. She did not perform a procedure. She encouraged him to follow an incredibly restrictive diet plan. Yes, but he did this voluntarily. On his own volition. Technically, he did this to himself. Linda.
But wait a minute. She recommended an overly restrictive diet plan.
Yes.
And he followed his doctor's terms. And she's not going to face any backlash.
Technically, and I'll get into it a little bit.
We do things that our doctors recommend all the time of our own volition.
Yeah. Yes.
But if our doctor recommended something,
And nowadays if our doctor recommended something outlandish like this, it would 100% be malpractice because we have the laws to cover that are now very robust and cover a lot of that verbiage. But back in that day, they did not have that. Those laws did not cover this specific subset of things. So.
Wow.
Linda goes on record claiming that her method worked, and these bad outcomes were because people were just not following her program the way it was outlined. And so, of course, they got worse, and she accepted absolutely no responsibility in any of the deaths whatsoever. Medical malpractice laws have actually been around in the United States since the 1800s, but basically only pertained to catastrophic failures of medicine and surgery. So if there was a clear neglect of patient duties, if a doctor saw that somebody had a stick sticking out of their chest and then said, we're not going to remove that, that's probably fine, then that would definitely be malpractice. But something a little bit more nuanced like this is not malpractice, according to these laws. These laws start becoming a lot more robust in the U.S. around 1950 and 1960 simply because medicine was advancing and becoming a lot more complicated. And there was more we could do surgically, more medicines on the market, and more treatments that were available. And in general, medicine was becoming more complex. And actually, in the 1970s, there was a malpractice crisis in the United States, which I did not know about until I read about it for this case.
Really?
Yeah. It was a massive spike in malpractice lawsuits across the U.S. in the 1970s, and it became very difficult for hospitals to staff And for because a lot of nurses and doctors were losing their jobs because hospitals were getting bankrupt. Doctors were getting sued. Nurses were getting sued. And a lot of insurance companies actually stopped insuring people just because it was so hard for people just to find insurance because everybody was fucking suing everybody in the medical, in like the medical legal world. And it was like this whole big thing.
It kind of sounds like it hasn't changed.
It's because there was this new money grabbing opportunity and people started, realizing that, oh, you know, this is bad and I should sue somebody about this because this bad medical thing happened to me. And, you know, that still happens today, but it's not as much of a frenzy as it was in the 1970s. It was just one of those things where it just like kind of came out and then it was this thing that everybody did was sue someone about a medical catastrophe.
Right.
So, it becomes clear to Linda that it was time for her to move on from this practice in Seattle. So, she had started burning her bridges again. So, she before, you know, she changed her location and that seemed to work, at least for a short period. So, she wants to try doing this again. Now, there's a small island off the coast of Seattle called Olala. And you can get there very easily by ferry. And it's pretty secluded. It was a very quiet, sort of beachy, sandy, grassy environment. And she felt very connected and very inspired. And she just absolutely fell in love with the island. She loved it there so much. And I'm going to build my own treatment center here. And the island did have a few residents and it had a very low population. But this population was among the more forward thinking and the more progressive of the greater Seattle area. So she thought, you know, if I'm going to be successful anywhere in the Seattle area, it's going to be here with these people. And that hopefully they'll be a lot more accepting of me. And then additionally, I think this was, you know, less about secluding people and treating them and being more successful in her treatments and more a way to isolate people away from their loved ones and away from their communities who could see what she was doing to people. This was out of the scrutiny of the public eye. And this was a way for her to conduct her business more under the radar and in the privacy of her own property so that she could do what she wanted to do without getting caught for a while. Because she said, if people are walking around in the community following my recommendations and then they die, it always looks bad on me. Well, yeah, because you're recommending these treatments.
Because your recommendations suck.
Yeah, they do. So,
I'm just saying.
Yeah. So her and Sam start buying land on Olala, and they start making plans to build this huge, beautiful treatment center in early 1910. So how it would work would be that they would build this main house where she and Sam would actually live, like on the upper floors. And then on the main floor of the house, there would be a medical office and then a treatment room so she could sort of work out of these areas. And they were going to build these small cabins adjacent to this main house where the patients or residents would actually stay. And so Linda laid out this whole vision and they start building it. And she names it Wilderness Heights.
Ooh. Oh, how beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Sounds very relaxing. So she hires on a nursing staff. She starts, you know, staffing the place and making preparations. And it takes a while to build things, especially on an island. You got to ferry everything over and it's kind of a big process. So while this place is being built and she's making arrangements to get it off the ground, she starts trying to track down and gain more clientele. And she starts reaching out to clients whom had read her book and then written her, like from all over the world. So there were a lot of people in Europe who were like writing her letters and reaching out to her, much like she had reached out to Dr. Dewey about his writings, because they loved her book so much and they really wanted to know her and hear from her and follow her method. So she starts collecting all these letters and saying, I'm going to call some of these people. And as far away as like England, France, you know, all over Europe. And what she would do is she would entice them by helping them find like temporary lodging in the Seattle area while her facility was being completed. And she said, what I'll do is I'm going to help you, you know, afford this apartment. I'm going to help you stay here in this apartment or in this rented house until we can move you to my sanitarium. And it's hypothesized that she would just hope that her patients would like give her a bunch of money and then, you know, die of starvation before they could actually catch on to what was really going on, because that's exactly what was going on. And it seemed as though Linda was starting to target those who came from affluent families more than anybody else. So her motives were becoming very clear. So for every patient who came to Seattle and devoted themselves to Linda's treatment, they all got the exact same fasting regimen. So they all got the 40 days of fasting, the daily enemas, the daily exercise, the eating oranges and tomato broth and nothing else. And that's interesting because, as we all know, you know, one size does not fit all in medicine. Like, no one treatment is perfect for every single person, you know. So as dangerous as this is, you know, it's even more dangerous that, you know, it was not tailored at all to her patients by any means. So one such affluent patient by the name of Eugene Wakeland had an entanglement with Linda. He was the son of a British lord who came upon Linda's book and felt very drawn to her methodologies. He shared his newfound passion with his family, who wrote her off as a quack and said, don't listen to this lady. This all sounds ridiculous. It sounds dangerous. Don't do it. Nevertheless, he said, nope, I'm going to the States. I'm going to go find Linda. He packs up his shit. He travels to the United States. And in 1910, he becomes one of Linda's first people that she takes care of. So she puts him up in a apartment in the Seattle area. 3 weeks after he arrived, the decomposing body of Eugene Wakeland was found in his apartment, and he had been shot. It's not 100% clear what happened here, but it is theorized that at some point, Linda became aware that Eugene may have not been as well off as she assumed he was based on who his family was. It turned out that he had actually borrowed money to get to the States, because when he left for the U.S., his family cut him off. They said, you are not going to be part, you're not going to have access to our funds and our wealth if you're going to go follow this quack lady. And he said, well, I'm doing it. So it's theorized that perhaps he was shot by either Linda or Sam, unfortunately, when they discovered that financially it would not be worth keeping him around and having him undergo the entire treatment. So one of them killed him.
Wow.
Isn't that wild?
Wow.
So Linda insisted that she and Sam had nothing to do with his death and that he must have died by suicide. Unfortunately, his body was badly decomposed by the time it was found, and there was so much decomposition that it was really hard to get any physical evidence to contradict that claim. So without evidence, they couldn't prosecute. They couldn't prove that there was any foul play there at all. In a very brazen move following Eugene's death, Linda sends an invoice to Eugene's lawyers overseas, billing them for funeral costs to the tune of $155. Today, that would be around $4,000. Yeah. Additionally, when his lawyers started looking into this, because they were like, what the hell is this lady talking about?
Yeah.
They discovered that he had signed power of attorney over to Linda prior to his death. Essentially, doing that was giving Linda full control.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
What? Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah, you did.
Power of attorney.
You heard that. Yeah, power of attorney.
To his doctor.
Uh-huh. So Linda essentially had control of his entire estate and all of his assets. She likely had him this before she knew that he independently was not worth a whole lot of money or a whole lot of anything. It turned out that his entire estate, his family cut him off, amassed to about $200, which today would have been around $6,000. So I'm sure it was not the amount that she was hoping for. But of course, she cleaned him out, took all of it.
What?
In mid-1910, Linda receives correspondence from two wealthy British heiresses, Claire and Dorothea Williamson, ages 33 and 37, respectively. The two sisters were born into wealth and were extremely close, having grown up in boarding schools all across Europe together. They were very close and grew up this way because their parents actually died at a young age and left them a large sum of money. And as a result, they didn't spend a whole lot of time in England, but they were incredibly well-traveled. They went to the most prestigious boarding schools, and they were always together. And they kind of just, like, lived all over Europe. They did have distant family kind of scattered all over Europe as well, so they would, sort of stay with them in between school semesters and things like that. And the two had an interest at a young age in osteopathy and alternative health pathways, and they often saw alternative practitioners in their travels when they were going around Europe. And this is where they came across the writings of Linda Hazard.
Uh-oh.
Linda takes the opportunity to return the correspondence and let them know that she's building this beautiful retreat on Washington's coast. It will be all about restorative health and osteopathy and reflect all of the teachings that are in my book. And naturally, the sisters were jumping at this opportunity and the invitation, and they headed to the States. And they had some family in California, so their plan was actually to spend some time in California with their family prior to checking into Linda's institution. They were like, you know what, we're going to take like a month or so and just chill in California. Then once we're done with our vacation, we will come and see you, Linda. And Linda was like, all right, cool, I will be waiting. So they communicated that whole plan to Linda. She was on board. And in the meantime, while she was waiting on the Williamson sisters to come, Linda starts scrounging up more affluent clientele. And she encounters John Flux. John was a wealthy British real estate tycoon. And he encountered Linda in his travels when he was looking into buying a ranch in the Pacific Northwest in the fall of 1910. He quickly fell under Linda's spell when the two crossed paths, and she took him into the treatment program and quickly put him up in an isolated apartment outside of Seattle as construction on her compound was finishing up. He begins his fast regimen in December of 1910. According to the book Starvation Heights that I mentioned in the first part, in the weeks that followed, John underwent rigorous fasting as well as, quote, hundreds of enemas. Hundreds.
Oh my gosh.
By the second week, he was so weak that he could not even tolerate sitting upright in bed.
Oh God.
This is heartbreaking.
Ugh.
Linda kept on him, though. She did not let up. She encouraged him not to give up. Continue to encourage him to follow the program.
Screw you, Linda.
Follow the program to a T. Because if you slip, you will get worse and you will die. She also encouraged him to exercise every single day. As he grew weaker and became unable to leave his bed, Linda reportedly abandoned him completely.
What?
She left him to die alone in his bed.
Come on.
And 53 days after beginning the program, John died alone in his bed.
She sucks.
She's the literal worst. She is a monster.
She's awful.
She's an utter monster.
Torturing this man for 53 days.
Very literally torturing the shit out of this guy. And at this point, too, it had become pretty standard for Linda to sign all of the death certificates of her patients that passed. And on his death certificate, she listed his cause of death as being pneumonia. Seems legit. So, Linda, Sam, or anybody else for that matter, nobody contacted any of John's family to let them know that he had passed. So John's father was left scratching his head when his son wouldn't return any of his correspondence, which was extremely unlike John. Additionally, he found that John's bank accounts were suddenly empty. He also...
Come on.
He also had holdings in Canada, which were also completely gone. Everything was gone. All of his assets were just suddenly gone.
Wiped clean.
So his father,
wiped clean,
not giving up and wanting to find out what the hell happened to my son, where is he, contacts the British consulate in the United States. So the consulate investigates and finally find out that John had died under Linda's care. And this is how his dad finds out that his son has died, this horrible, horrific death. And
that's so sad.
He is, of course, devastated and furious and extremely suspicious of something fishy going on with this doctor lady. And The consulate starts investigating Linda. Linda says, well, he really didn't have any money on him when he got here, which his dad knew was not true because his dad knew that John had taken several hundred dollars out of the bank before he left for the States, which would have been on his person. That's how people carried their money back then. They just carried cash.
Of course.
And so he would have had cash on his person. That also was gone. So what the hell? Where's all the money, Linda? Where's the money? So...
Frickin' Linda.
So John's father does everything he can to try and bring Linda to justice because he knew that she had left him to die, taken all of his assets. Unfortunately, there was just no proof. And there were no laws outlining, again, that she did anything illegal. All she did was recommend a diet, which he followed, and he starved himself to death in the eyes of the law.
How long does it take to catch this woman and, like, find a way to, like, stop her?
I know. Isn't it wild? Isn't this crazy that she was allowed to just keep doing this?
This so, is awful.
Similar cases follow. Patient by patient, mainly affluent people would line up, enroll in her program, only to die under these very suspicious circumstances, always cachectic, malnourished, dehydrated, shells of human beings. This is what she's leaving in her wake. So, days after John Flux dies, here come the Williamson sisters. Remember the Williamson sisters? They were chilling in California. They were really excited to head to Seattle when they planned to meet up with their new health mentor, Dr. Linda Hazard.
Oh, dear.
So,
what a mentor.
Of course, Linda welcomes them with some open arms, and Claire had claimed to have suffered from chronic pelvic pains, for which she had seen many doctors in the past. Nobody could really offer her much of an explanation or much of a treatment. She had been told by practitioners in the past that she had a, quote, tipped uterus, which is pretty common, doesn't typically cause a whole lot of symptoms, but it's widely believed that what she may have actually been suffering from was endometriosis. Endometriosis is a condition in which the cells that are supposed to only occur within the uterine lining as we build our uterine lining every month actually start occurring outside the uterine wall and commonly occur on the ovaries, on the fallopian tubes, even on the outside of the uterus and in the abdominal cavity, on the abdominal wall, other organs, and in severe cases can even migrate to like other vital organs like our heart and lungs. It can become, you know, a very debilitating thing. Even mild endometriosis can cause chronic pelvic pain, low back pain, very heavy periods. It can actually be incapacitating. So of course, GYN issues like this in women back in the day were far less documented. They were not well understood. Nobody gave a shit about women's issues, like, let's be honest. So nobody really understands. And her complaints were probably just written off by multiple doctors. So it makes perfect sense that she was seen by a ton of providers and wasn't really given an explanation. And then her sister, Dorothea, who went by Dora, had a slightly different complaint. So she complained of widespread joint pains and had told Linda that she believes she suffers from some form of rheumatism. So it's possible that she had some form of arthritis. Who knows? It could have been a rheumatoid thing. We're not sure. So both ladies had these chronic ailments and they were looking for relief and were hoping to find some solace with Linda's program. So the ladies travel to Olala, not telling anybody in their family where they were going or what they were doing for fear of being ridiculed for their alternative beliefs. Now, these two ladies were incredibly wealthy. And Linda knew this. When their parents died at a young age, they were left with this massive, hefty fortune. And which, I mean, that supported them through their childhood and would have essentially left them set for life. This made them ideal clients for Linda. And on that very ominous note, we'll see you in part three. Yep.
No. She's doing a happy dance like she loves her cliffhangers.
Oh, I shouldn't do a happy dance because what happens to the Williamson sisters is incredibly tragic and horrific.
Know.
It's the worst thing in the world. It's the worst. You're going to have to come back for part three, though.
I want to know what happens to Linda. I hope everyone else is going, WTF, Linda.
Oh, fuck yeah, they are. Oh, I actually do know how she dies. I actually do know what happens till, obviously, she's not with us anymore. And I actually do know how she dies, and it's incredibly satisfying. It's incredibly satisfying.
Yeah?
Yes.
Oh, good. I love those.
Yeah,
love
you could probably guess. Okay. I won't let you, though, because I don't want to spoil it for the rest of the listeners out there.
Thank you for listening, everyone. You can look for us on Instagram at MedCrimes Podcast.
You can X us at MedCrimes PC.
That doesn't even make any sense.
I know. It's really dumb. Just call it fucking Twitter. It's always Twitter.
You can find us on Facebook at MedCrimes Podcast.
If you wish to become a Patreon, you can find us at www.patreon.com/MedCrimesPodcast and join our family and get a mythical creature assigned to you of your very own. Who knows what it'll be?
And try to be Patreon number 100.
Yeah, buddy.
It's coming.
It's coming.
It's coming. And if you want to send us any of your crazy stories and communicate with us, you can send us an email at medcrimes@gmail.com.
We love you.